This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Of course, I'm Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, coming to you from my home studio. My producer, Lee Delapina, is in our main studio in the heart of the Bluegrass, Lexington, Kentucky. As always, you are listening to the show live throughout North America on Sirius 219 XM, channel 201, or you're tuned in to our free live streaming or the archived podcast of the program, and you're doing that on our HRN website, horseracingradio.net. Excited to have you along for the ride for the next hour. You know, our most recent episode of Trainer Talk featured my hour-long conversation with recently retired trainer Kieran McLaughlin. And if you missed it, just go back to our website, check it out. It was a fantastic hour. But I bring it up because Kieran has saddled nearly 1,600 winners in his career. My guest on today's show has saddled one. And that's what I love about this Trainer Talk program. It is so cool to visit with some of the trainers who have made their mark in the sport already and then other trainers who are just getting started with their careers. So please join me in welcoming the native of Manhasset, New York, whose first career win came at Gulfstream Park on April 4th in the first race on that day's card. He is trainer Matthew O'Connor, and he is with me now on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Matt, welcome to the program.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, excited to hear your story. And like I say, you're only roughly, I guess it's about 1,576 wins behind Kieran. But I kind of have a feeling with your pedigree, you're going to get there.
I hope so. If I could be half the trainer and the man Kieran is, I'm being in shape.
Yeah, you're not kidding. One of the true class acts and great ambassadors for the sport. You know, I was looking up some information as I was getting ready for the program. And, of course, Manhasset is located on Long Island, not far from Belmont Park. Your father was born in Saratoga, so I guess it was kind of a foregone conclusion that somehow you would find your way working with the sport of Kings.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And ever since I was born, since I was an infant, I've spent every summer of my life up in Saratoga. I have family up there. Love the town, love the racing, and I guess it was a step towards where I am today.
What was it about the sport that initially captured you?
When I was younger, it was obviously just the uniqueness of being around horses, especially growing up on Long Island, where it's more of a suburb of the city. But as it went along, I became to realize more of what goes on behind the scenes in the game. Specifically that challenge of trying to figure horses out and develop them into something and all their little quirks and niches like that. That's what kind of made me want to train horses.
Yeah, I can remember growing up, I was in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, which was just over an hour from Saratoga. So like you, I cut my teeth on racing and was introduced to the sport at Saratoga. And quite honestly, Matt, I can't think of a better place. All due respect to the Keenelands and Santa Anitas and Delmars of the world, Saratoga is a unique place, and what a way to be introduced to the sport.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, without a doubt. Saratoga is like basically walking back in time. It's very old school, the ambiance of the town and everything, and it's my favorite racetrack in so far America. I haven't been able to go overseas yet, so hopefully we make it somewhere over there one day, but Saratoga is definitely number one racetrack in America, in my opinion.
You know, I tell the story quite often on this show and some of my other shows that it was the 1989 Travers with Easy Goer that really got me hooked. And he was the first horse I truly fell in love with. So I tell Shug all the time that I blame Shug McGahee for getting me involved in this sport because he, of course, trained Easy Goer. how about for you? Was there a horse maybe at Saratoga or someplace else that attracted you to the sport that you just fell in love with?
Yeah, when I was a few years old, my dad had a horse with Dennis Ryda, obviously. And I spent some time in his barn, and there was this one horse called Backstreet Girl, or I called her Blackstreet at the time, being semi-toddler. And I bought an alarm. My great-grandmother actually bought me an alarm clock, and I'd set it every morning when we were in Saratoga for 6 a.m. to wake me and my father up and take me to the barn.
Yeah, it's incredible how you just become, hooked on these horses, and you do anything you can to follow them. Trust me, I was not a cigar fan. I was a Holy Bull fan, and I always said you'd never hear a cigar if Holy Bull stayed healthy. But I remember when Cigar was on that long winning streak and he had a public workout at Saratoga, my wife and I got up at the crack of dawn and drove over there to be at Saratoga when he had that final workout before he went out to California. I think he was going for the Pacific Classic where he got beat, actually. But I was there for that final workout. And I'm not a morning person, so for me to do that, that was a big thing.
Yeah, definitely. Once you get hooked on the game, you'll do anything to make a sacrifice to be there and experience a day at the races, you know?
Well, let's go back to the beginning here and talk about growing up in Manhasset. I mentioned it's close to Belmont Park. It's a Native American word that means the island neighborhood, and there are several famous people that have been born in Manhasset, including NFL star running back Jim Brown. You had Boomer Esiason, longtime NFL quarterback who was from Manhasset, former Major League pitcher R.A. Dickey, Mike Francesa, longtime radio show host on WFAN in New York, Patrick McEnroe, the tennis player. I even read where Leonard Marsh, the co-founder of Snapple, and Jim McCann, the founder and CEO of 1-800-Flowers, all hail from Manhasset. So I guess you're the next in a long line of big-name folks that are going to come from Manhasset. Is that right?
I hope so. I was born in Manhasset, but I grew up in New Hyde Park, so even closer to Belmont, actually.
Wow. Yeah. Where'd you go to end up going to school?
For high school, I went to Kellenberg Memorial in Uniondale, and then I did 2 years studying business management at Long Island University. And then I ended up transferring for my last 2 years to the University of Arizona's racetrack industry program to get my degree in animal sciences.
So this was always something you were going to do. Was there a time when you were in high school or going to school at Long Island University that you said, maybe I'll do something a little bit different with my life?
No, honestly, I did well in school, but I never really wanted to be there. I'd rather be at the racetrack, and it definitely wasn't easy. I contemplated going to work at the barn out of high school, and my parents pushed me to go to college, and I went out there, and through my 2 years at Long Island University, the racetrack was obviously still an heavy emphasis in my mind, and decided that the best way to progress forwardly and get my degree would be to go out to Arizona and study the racetrack industry program there. And that kind of, I guess it was ever since I was younger, obviously, like everybody, I wanted to be a jockey, but that didn't happen as I'm 6'3 and 185 pounds. But once that option was up, it was train and race horses, and that's what I knew I wanted to do and just took the steps to be able to do that.
You know, you said you did well in school. I think that's a bit of an understatement when you take a look at some of the honors that you received, including the Beta Gamma Sigma, which is an exclusive international business honor society. You were inducted into that one as a business major. You were really focused as a student as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I believe anything you do, you have to give your all doing it. And when school was the priority at the time, and did my best to make my parents proud, get good marks, and hopefully that would lead to opening more doors. And now I have the degree, I have those various honor societies, and I'm doing what I love now, so it's always good.
Did they encourage you to become involved with horse racing, or what was that conversation like?
Well, my mom and dad knew I was basically addicted to the game when I was younger, and they never put any pressure on me to do anything specific. They kind of let me just carve my own path, and whatever made me happy and whatever I wanted to do business-wise in my life, that they fully supported me, and my dad supports me great, as well as my mom. actually, that horse that I won my first race with is owned by my father, too, which was a fun experience.
Yeah, that's great. We'll talk about that here in just a minute. Visiting with Matt O'Connor, who is just getting started with his career, won his first race at Gulfstream Park on April 4th, and we'll talk about that moment and that day and what that means to him and maybe his career going forward. But back to Long Island University for a minute. Last year there was a debate as to the name, the mascot, and what they should name the university. It was previously known as what, the Blackbirds? Is that right, Matt?
They were, when I was there, they were the Pioneers.
Okay. And what was the whole debate about with the new naming of the new mascot?
I'm not sure. I wasn't there at the time, but I think they changed their mascot to the Long Island University Sharks.
Yeah. Yeah, I read that. They said they took a vote. It was between Sharks, Eagles, and Falcons. You okay with Sharks?
Yeah, I mean, it does. Doesn't really bother me. I'm a University of Arizona man.
All right, let's talk about those years. So you go to the University of Arizona. What led to that decision, just to be on the racing side of things?
Yeah, that, and I wasn't having a great time at Long Island University. I mean, not socially, but more academically. I didn't really like taking the business classes. They were kind of boring to me, and I've looked into the racetrack industry program through my one of my close friends growing up, Robbie Dima, who went there, and he ended up changing his major at Arizona. But I went out there to visit and fell in love with this school and everything about it, and decided to take the step to go out there.
Yeah, that's a great program, and we do some work with them here on the network. I've been out there for the symposium in the past. Bobby Newman, who works with us, former track announcer at Calder, and he still calls races here and there. Bobby attended that school. Todd Pletcher, I know. Eric Zimney up at Charlestown. Several people I know who have come through that program. What makes it so good, Matt?
I think that they teach the racing industry in a broad spectrum of it, in regards to that they have racing office classes, paramutuals, racing law, more hands-on classes, like yearling prep and stuff like that, and they kind of cover all corners of the industry, and I guess you get to gauge what, I guess, interests you the most going there, and they help you network and interact and get internships and whatnot with big organizations in the industry, and I think that's the great thing about it.
Yeah, outside of the training, obviously the obvious training path that you took, what were some of the other aspects of that course and that program that attracted you?
I think the paramutual and business side of it, you kind of develop an appreciation for everything that goes on in track management and what it takes to operate a racetrack. And then obviously they had a racing office class, and you learn, we had a project called the Matrix Project, and you write your own condition book, and you're allotted a certain amount of money, and it was just a very interesting overall experience.
Do you think you might find yourself on the business side of horse racing at some point?
I'm not sure. I mean, maybe down the line if things change, but I love training race horses, and that's what I plan to do for many years.
All right, so why does somebody choose to get up at, what, 3, 4 a.m., 365 days a year, and go to a barn and be around horses and train horses, as opposed to, well, sleeping in till 7 or 8 and then showing up for an office job?
I think it's for the love of the game, obviously. If you're waking up, like me waking up at 4:30 every morning, it's just another day. It's not like I'm going out of my way to do it. It's what I want to do. It's what I love to do, and I have no problem doing that.
Yeah, visiting with Matt O'Connor here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. All right, Matt, take me through the years and the time after you graduated from the University of Arizona and getting into the training side.
So I actually graduated from Arizona this past December, a semester early. I overloaded on credits to get through it, and I came down here. The plan was to come down to South Florida and get going, and purchased a Duelist in March, and ever since then been full-time at the barn and picked up some two-year-olds under his 3-year-old colt, and here we are today.
Yeah, do list the name of your very first winner. But that moment when he crossed the finish line, what was that like, Matt?
It was definitely exciting, especially the way he won that race, coming from basically dead last. And it was just, everything came full circle. You know, I can't really describe the feeling, but it was just, it was one of the happiest feelings you could have.
Yeah, you said you purchased Duelist. What was it? First of all, what sale? And then what was it about Duelist that attracted you?
So I didn't purchase him out of a sale. Carlo Vacareza is a good friend of mine, and I moved into his barn at Palmetto, his barn 40, and he was going to Lexington because he's opening a new restaurant up there, and he's taking the horses with him. But he had a group of horses that he wanted to sell that he didn't think could necessarily be competitive in Kentucky. And out of that list, being in the barn, Duelist is the one who caught my eye, and we were able to work out a deal and transfer him over to me and get going that way.
Did you ever imagine that he was going to run that big? I mean, I know you hoped he would, but did you ever imagine that it would all happen the way it did?
Well, it definitely happened fast, but he was training so well going into the race. We were confident in him. We were confident in him the first time we ran him. He had a little traffic trouble, but we were able to get the win second time out, and he's doing great out of that race, and hopefully run him in the coming weeks.
How do you describe your training philosophy, Matt?
I take a lot of stuff that I learned from working with Nick Zito. It's very, very hands-on, very specific, and try to figure out the little quirks and little things that these horses try to tell you and try to correct their problems and whatnot and get them to progress forward.
Yeah, it's not as easy as it sounds, though, is it?
Oh, no, definitely not. I mean, you have to basically look at every single little thing you could possibly imagine and know how to read it, and obviously have a great team around you, vet-wise, blacksmith, staff. And it's definitely challenging, but that's the fun in it.
You know, I've been a huge Nick Zito fan for a very, very long time. When my wife first got involved in horse racing and became hooked on the sport shortly after we started seeing each other, Nick Zito was her favorite trainer, so we followed a lot of his horses. What is it about Nick Zito that makes him so good?
I think that what makes Nick Zito so good is not only does he get good horses, but he has an eye for little things that other trainers don't think of or specifically focus on. And he's very, very straightforward with the horses, and he just does an overall great job trying to figure them out. And that's what I took from Nick to try to apply it to my training regimen.
What kind of teacher is he?
He was great with me. He took a lot of time out of his schedule and showed me every little thing you could possibly imagine. He actually, two summers ago, I was rubbing Giuseppe the Great, and he didn't like the way I was doing it. He got down on his own two knees and rubbed them and showed me exactly how he wanted it done.
What were you doing wrong?
Nick's very specific on, like specific in regards to the way, like, for say, poultice is put on. He has a different way. He doesn't just slap it on. He massages it in. And it's a lot more attentive. And that was like kind of my wake-up call at that point, to pay attention, try to take everything I could from that man, because he was just very focused.
How long did you work with Nick?
I worked with Nick for 2 years, the last 2 years before I decided to go out on my own.
So what would you say are the couple of things that Nick Zito does that you make sure that, come hell or high water, you're going to be doing that with your operation?
I think the number one takeaway from Nick is attention to detail, whether that be basically the appearance of the barn, not a straw out of place or something of that nature. I think that was the main takeaway from Nick. Make sure everything is done right, done with the horse in mind, and done with class and purpose.
What other horses did you have the chance to be around outside of Giuseppe the Great when you were working with Nick?
When I was with Nick, we had Fermento was in the barn. A lot of 2-year-olds came in. One that Nick is high on right now, Hunt the Front, is he ran a couple good races at Elkhorn, but those were the two quote-unquote big horses when I was in Nick's barn.
But you've been around big horses before. I know when you were working with Dominic Scatino, you spent some time working with Grade 1 winner Greenpoint Crusader. You also were around Kentucky Derby winner Always Dreaming, right?
Yes.
Tell me about those two horses. How cool was that?
Well, that was definitely an experience, and that was kind of the first big horses that I was around, especially Greenpoint Crusader and Always Dreaming early in his career. And they were both class acts from the moment they came in. You knew they were good horses. They just have this kind of radiance around them, you know. They stand out.
Do good horses really have that quality about them where you can almost tell that they're different?
I believe so. I mean, once in a while you get that sleeper horse who doesn't show much in the mornings or is a little quirky and you don't really think he's much and they'll surprise you. But horses like Always Dreaming and Greenpoint, they definitely had some element about them that made them stand out in their specific ways.
Where were you the day that Always Dreaming won the Derby?
I was actually there in the owner's suite with my Uncle Anthony. That was an unforgettable experience, obviously, but it was surreal.
Yeah, tell me about that whole experience. For those of us who have never had the privilege of being with somebody when they win the Kentucky Derby, or knowing somebody that owns a Kentucky Derby winner, tell me a little bit about what that day was like.
It was definitely a long day. We got there very early and spent some time in the barn before the race, went over, enjoyed the undercard prior to it. And I think the greatest thing about the Derby was the walk over. When you're on that track and you're looking at the grandstand and you see 100,000 some people cheering and talking and you're interacting with them on the rail, that was kind of the coolest experience of my life in regards to the Derby.
Yeah, the walkover is incredible. I always describe it when we're doing the broadcast of the race. I like to describe it as similar, I assume, similar to walking up the 18th green to the 18th green on a Sunday at Augusta for the Masters. It's got to be that type of powerful walk, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely. It's kind of an out-of-body experience. Like, the way I envisioned it was something like you said, but in regards to that, like walking out of the tunnel for a boxing match. And it was just overall a really fun experience.
Wow.
Especially when you were able to walk out with the win.
Describe it as like a boxing match. Did you get a little pumped up when you were on the walkover?
Oh, yeah. I was pumped up all day. We knew he was going into it well, and we were definitely excited. But he ran probably he did run the biggest race of his life that day, and it was just a lot of fun.
One of my favorite people, and he's been on the program many times with me, is Vinny Viola of St. Elias Stables, and, you know, of course, part owners of Always Dreaming. Terry Finley, West Point, also involved. Really good people, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Vinny is an A1 guy, and as well as Terry Finley, and they were definitely great to have along with the journey, especially Vinny was in on Greenpoint Crusader as well, so that was just my uncle's had a lot of success in partnership with Vinny, and he's a great family friend of ours.
Was your uncle always a fan of horse racing?
Yeah, he was a fan of it, and he took him a trip to Saratoga to actually get into it in 2006, and ever since then he's had horses and he's been very successful as an owner.
How many horses does he have now? Do you know?
I'm not sure right now.
Are you training any horses for him?
I couldn't give you a number.
You training any horses for him?
Not yet. Hopefully he gives me a shot when he gets one for me.
Yeah, come on. We got to tell Vinny.
I'm sure he'll come.
Vinny's got to give you a couple of those St. Elias horses.
I hope so. That would be great. I'd love to train for Vinny. He's a great man.
Young Matthew O'Connor with me here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton, just getting started with this training career. Matt, is that something that, for a young trainer, you have to almost earn the right to train the types of horses that, say, a St. Elias Stables typically has?
Oh, yeah, I think absolutely that you have to prove yourself. No one's going to entrust you with a several hundred thousand dollar racehorse out of the gate. And I think you got to prove what you could do with the cheaper ones and move them up forwardly and have success, and the good ones will come after that.
So when you saddled your first winner a few weeks ago, what was the reaction from other horsemen?
Well, we had a lot of great feedback, lots of congratulations. And we were in touch with some owners who wanted to claim and purchase two-year-olds at these later two-year-old sales now.
Really?
And so hopefully come summertime we have a little bigger of a string and more opportunities to show what we could do.
So it can work just like that. You saddle a winner, the phone starts ringing, and all of a sudden you're kind of off and running. Is that the right way to say it?
Yeah, exactly. I think the marketing plan in horse racing as a trainer is win races and have success, and from that you'll drum up attention and more interest from owners, and therefore getting more stock to work with.
How many horses would you like to have?
I'm not sure, to be honest with you. I don't think I could ever manage to have the number of heads that these quote-unquote super trainers have. But something like a Nick Zito-type operation, 40, 50 horses at its peak, I think that's the ballpark range where you could, like, still pay attention to the small details and be more hands-on with them. And anything over that number kind of gets tricky.
Would you want to have strings at different racetracks or just one track?
Obviously, I love Florida, and this would probably be where I winter, and by the look of things so far this year, end up staying down here. But Florida and New York are probably the two places that I would love to have strings year-round, and then obviously maybe stopping in Keeneland on the way down for the winter.
Yeah, you know, you picked one heck of a time to launch your training career, too. Of course, you don't know that COVID-19 is coming along, but all of a sudden this hits, and you've really got to – it's almost baptism under fire, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, exactly. It's definitely an interesting situation within, I guess, the thoroughbred market and whatnot right now, but we've been lucky enough down here at Gulfstream to still have racing, and it's helping the horsemen out down here, and I know – people elsewhere are kind of struggling in regarding business-wise, but so far so good down here.
Yeah, so many things that you have to deal with, not only just getting started with your training career and the things that come along with it, but now you have to deal with this too, and it sounds like you're handling everything quite well, and now you're off and running with that first winner. How many horses do you currently have in training now, Matt?
We have a string of four right now at Palm Meadows, and Duelist is the only one that's fit enough to run right now. We have a three-year-old that just came off the farm, and two-year-olds that came off the farm about a month ago. And those, that group of three had their first works today and yesterday. So hopefully in a couple months we'll be full speed ahead with four, hopefully more.
Yeah, I want you to walk me through the process of taking a horse that comes off the farm, just comes into your barn, getting him ready for the races. I want you to walk me through what you're going to have to do with those horses, but we'll do that on the second half of the program after this short commercial break. Stay with us. This is Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton, and I'm visiting with trainer Matthew O'Connor here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Well, Fasig's family, basically. Some of the guys that work here I've known for 30 years. I just felt really supported, and they're great communicators. They try to help in whatever you do.
Fasig Tipton's has a sale for every market, every segment in the industry. There's multiple opportunities where you're gonna have plenty of good buying and selling situations.
Great customer service. I'm not only a buyer with them, but I'm a seller, and I've always been well taken care of.
There's a lot of different things that sometimes you need at a sale, and Fasig Tipton is there every step of the way.
They show year after year that they're ethical and they're fair, and they enjoy what they do. But when you're around people that have a combination of all those things, you know, you can't lose.
Bloom Racing. Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Pulling away from Come Dancing, Mopetism, and the others, Midnight Bizou leaves no doubt today. she won the FIPS in hand.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
Time-tested Broken Vow continues to deliver quality black-type stakes horses at a 15% clip. The top son of Unbridled has sired over 150 black-type horses, 80 black-type winners, and over $75 million in earnings. Among the 12 black-type horses sired by Broken Vow in 2019 was dual Canadian Classic winner Tone Broke, winner of classic races on dirt and turf. Also the sire of Imprimis, the Speedy Keeneland graded stakes winner of over $440,000. Give your mare a great start with a proven sire. Broken Vow, standing at Pin Oak Stud.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Up front, the battle rages on. Took a cab and Blessed Journey continue to throw punches. Three wide and Highway Flyer. Fuentes going to try to thread the needle for Dramatic Kit, and he's now fourth. Up on the outsider, Mondo's team begins to gain ground. Big Treasure did not go on. Punchline never got any waste place to go. After three quarters and 111 and one, there's now an eighth of a mile to go. Punchline's going to get out now, and here he comes. Here comes Punchline to take on Dramatic Kitten and Took a Cab. Down the center and Duelist in deep stretch. It's Duelist and Punchline coming on. Duelist to the front. Duelist and Gaffleon with a patient ride to win it. Dramatic Kitten is second. Third is Punchline. Fourth is Took a Cab in 136 and one.
Duelist with the big victory, the first career win for my guest here on Trainer Talk this afternoon. That is trainer Matthew O'Connor. That happened April 4th at Gulfstream Park in the first race of the day, and Pete Aiello bringing them home. Don't forget, if you missed any portion of this show or any of our Trainer Talk shows, it's simple. All you have to do is head back to our website, horseracingradio.net, to check out the podcasts of this show and all of our programs. They're there for you, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on Apple Podcasts. Well, Matt, I hear that call, and I know that you're listening to it as well, and you hear it on radio. What goes through your mind when you're listening to Pete bring him home?
It put a smile on my face, to be honest with you.
It should. You talked about the moment when he won and what it can mean to your career and how the phone started ringing a little bit as soon as he crossed the finish line. But put me there with you. He crosses the finish line in front.
I was there standing right outside the grandstand with me and my groom, and I didn't bring a hot walker up because of the limitations with the coronavirus. And my parents actually watched it from the parking lot. We were lucky enough to get on the track and get a replacement of a wind picture, just a picture with him, and walk back to the test barn past my parents cheering, and it was just a great time.
Are you allowed to be in the winner's circle with him?
The winner's circle was closed, so they're actually doing no wind pictures.
Okay.
But one of the photographers there was kind enough to snap a pic right outside of the winner's circle for me.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, because I was wondering how they would handle that. With trying to deal with the coronavirus situation and being 6 feet apart. How does everybody deal with that when the horse is coming back after winning a race?
Well, they were allowing one person per horse on the way back. Obviously, I told them it was my first win and I was going out there no matter what. But it was Gulfstream took a bunch of precautions in regards to that, and have even gotten a little stricter now. They're requiring people to wear masks and gloves the whole time that they're on the grounds over there. And we've been lucky enough to be able to keep running, and I think it's because of all these precautions Gulfstream took.
You know, it's such a big deal, not just for you as a trainer, but you mentioned your groom being with you. What's it mean for the groom who is there day in and day out with that horse to have the horse finally win a race?
It was definitely exciting, and that groom that I have was actually his groom when he was with Vacareza, and he stayed down here with me when Carlo went north, and the horses are like children to those guys who take care of them every day, as they basically are to me, and the hot walkers and the whole team. They're part of the family, you know?
Yeah, and if people are just joining us, that was a horse that you had purchased off of Carlo Vacareza before he came up here to Lexington to get ready to open his restaurant, which I believe is supposed to open in September. It's called Frank and Dino's. They do a lot to support the PDJF, and that's our official charity here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, so a lot of tie-ins. I've been there for some of the events at Frank and Dino's in Florida, and let me tell you, the food at that place is second to none.
Oh, yeah, Frank and Dino's is a go-to down here for sure.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. Talking with Matthew O'Connor here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Matt, you talked in the first half of the show about learning from guys like Nick Zito, the Hall of Famer, and you talked about what makes him so good. But you're only 22 years old. And guys like Nick and Shug McGahee, for example, I guess they could be considered old school. They do things a certain way. And you learn from a guy like Nick. How do you describe yourself? If they're old school, what are you?
I'm obviously not old school being so young, but definitely we have a lot of old school elements about the way we do things. But I also work for Robert Falcone Jr. and Dominic Schettino, and I kind of took little things from them each and kind of put it all together and have my own program. I don't know what to coin it, but it's definitely a unique program.
Yeah, both of those guys have also been on this program past couple of years. What did you take away from Dominic and from Robert Falcone that you're using today?
So with Dominic, I that's when I really got to work with the babies and quality babies such as Green Point Crusader and Always Dreaming, and that's kind of where I took away how I deal with the 2-year-olds. And also Dominic is where I learned just basic horsemanship from the time I was about 8-9 years old. And then when I turned, I think 17, 18, is when I went to work with Robert Falcone for a year. And from him, he's a great claiming trainer. He knows ways to improve horses and move them up off the claim and get them to be successful long term. And I think that's where I took the claiming aspect of it from.
What's the biggest difference between working with a claiming horse and working with a young horse that you just get into your barn trying to get him ready for the races?
Obviously with the young horses, it's all about getting them fit enough and kind of dealing with them, because the younger horses they're a little quirkier in regards to mentality and stuff like that. When you get a claiming horse, they're dead set in their ways, and you just have to figure out how to work with them, what their problems are, how to help them with their problems, and hopefully get them to move forward.
Yeah, we hear that a lot. A trainer will move a horse up when they get them into their barn after claiming them, meaning that they'll improve their performance somehow. How does a trainer go about doing that, Matt?
I think it's specifically figuring out like what their problem is. Say they have a little bit of an ankle or something like that. Obviously, injections, which I haven't had to do yet. Hopefully, I'll never have to do, but. And then in regards to that, I think it's just the overall what their training program is, how they deal with them, whether they press them hard or they're a little easier on them, their feed program, what supplements they give. And it's just an overall big picture of going from one person's training regimen into another one that may help the horse.
Yeah, and let's be perfectly clear. You mentioned injections. You say, well, I hope I don't have to do that. We're talking about things that are completely legal and approved by the racing commissions that you can do. It's a lot like an athlete who gets a cortisone shot, for example. Those types of things. I just want to make sure that people understand when you're saying that you're not saying, hey, I'm going to, drug all my horses, because that's not what you're saying when you're describing that.
No, it's just to help with pressure and joints and what stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, toward the end of the first half of the program, you talked about getting horses in your barn and getting them right off the farm. So when they come to you off the farm, walk me through the process for people that have never had the chance to be around a trainer's operation. Walk me through the process of getting a horse from that stage and the things you have to do to get them ready to enter the starting gate in an actual race.
Well, the first thing I do when I get horses in front of the farm, I usually jog them for a week or two and try to feel them out, see what they're all about in regards to that. And then obviously get a little more serious with galloping for several weeks before breezing. And I like to breeze my horses like Zito did when they first came in. So they go like 3/8 from the quarter pole, teach them to run through the wire and finish up. And as it goes along, they get more fit and you're able to breeze them longer and excuse me. you're able to breed them longer and get more serious with them. And as that goes along, you have to teach them the gate and breeze from the gate to get a gate card. And it's a long process, but it's fun to watch them from phase one up to their progression to racing.
Yeah, I've had other trainers. Matter of fact, Bob Baffert has often described himself as being the coach of these horses. Is that really what a trainer ultimately is?
Yeah, I think the best way to put it in layman terms is being a personal trainer and a nutritionist for the animal. That's how, when people ask me what I do, that's the way I put it. And that's basically what it is.
If you could trade places with any trainer in the game right now, who would it be?
That's a tough one. I'd probably have to go with Baffert just because he doesn't have too many horses, but the horses that he does have are all quality horses. I feel like that's what you have to aspire to be.
Have you had much time, or have you spent much time around Bob Baffert?
I haven't. I've spoken to him at Keeneland, and one time he came out to Arizona for the symposium this past winter. But other than that, not really.
Did you have any other trainers that, as you were growing up and thinking about getting into the profession, outside of the ones that we've talked about, were there other guys that you would watch or maybe even idolize in some respects?
Being in New York, the two guys that I watched specifically how they trained and breed their horses would be Todd and Chad Brown. And I try to take what I saw. Obviously, I don't know everything about their training regimen, not having worked for them, but being able to see how they physically train their horses and breed them, I think, is what I took away from outside people.
Yeah, now you're in Florida with those guys. Do you ever take time to maybe in the mornings walk over and pick their brain a little bit?
No, I haven't had a chance because I've been so busy in the barn. We have a small operation and we're very hands-on right now, so I'm kind of just focused on my program right now and trying to perfect my craft.
Matthew O'Connor with me on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Matt, I can remember many, many times, and I've been doing this now, almost 20 years, I guess, but I can remember when we were first starting the network, and one of the things we would do was, you know, and we still do it, we would go sit down with trainers and go up and maybe ask them for an interview or whatever it would be, jockeys too. And I can remember oftentimes there were plenty of times that I was completely intimidated to go up to some of these individuals and ask them for just a minute of their time because I didn't want to bother them. So when you walk into the paddock and, for example, you're going to see Nick Zito and you're going to see Shug McGahee and you're going to see Todd and you're going to see Chad, is there an element of intimidation on your part, or is it more a young confidence type of thing that, hey, I'm here to play too?
It's definitely a young confidence type of thing, walking in and seeing guys like that. Obviously, you know what they've done in the industry and all the great horses they've trained, and that's who you aspire to be. And being on the racetrack, it's a big family, you know. Everybody's friendly. Everybody will help you out if you need something, but it's definitely I'd like to represent myself and not worry about the bigger trainers, because obviously hopefully one day when I have stock like theirs, I could do exactly what they're doing.
Yeah, if you visit your website, by the way, I think that's fantastic that you already have a website set up and it looks great. It's mbo'connorracing.com, and you have different categories to that website, which is cool, and your bio is on there. But when you go to the website, one of the things that you're going to see right on the homepage is the slogan that you have. And that slogan I thought was really neat: meticulous care, meticulous training. Tell me what that means.
It's just, again, it's a mantra I took from Nick Zito, being extremely attentive and paying attention to the littlest of details, whether it be a dirty shed row or a horse being 1% off and being able to catch it, the horses off their feed, stuff like that. And that slogan comes straight from what I learned from Zito.
There's a picture of you, too, with a horse, which it's a great picture. I don't know who took the picture, but it's fantastic, right on the homepage. And the horse is it Coach Villa or Villa?
Yeah, Coach Villa. He's a horse my dad bred that we had with Nick Zito. And he got claimed away, but he's still running. hopefully we get some more Breeders' Rewards checks when they open up racing in New York for him.
Yeah, do you find that as a young 22-year-old trainer just getting started, that things like the internet and a website and social media are important to helping you get your name out and grow your business?
Absolutely. I think social media is the main proponent to getting your name out there. Because nowadays, every day, everybody's on their phone or they're reading something on their phone on social media or whatnot, and just you popping up on their feed, and I think, makes them think about it for a second.
Do you follow me on social media?
I do. I follow you on Twitter.
Yeah, that's the answer I was looking for. I was actually expecting you to say no, to be honest with you.
No, I do. And I think you could see that. Like, after Duelist won his first race, I picked up 120 Twitter followers. So I think Social media is a major proponent.
Can it help you grow your business?
What's that?
Can it help you grow your business and add more horses to your stable, do you think?
I definitely think so, because there's a lot of major owners in training operations, bloodstock services, and practically anyone who's involved in the racing industry is on social media, and I think them being able to see your success on the track on social media makes them, once again, think about it and look into you a little more.
Well, you obviously had the business background. We talked about that in the first half of the program and the accolades you received when you were in college. Then you went out to the University of Arizona. You went through their program and learned some other aspects of the sport. But so often for a young trainer, I hear that the business side of training racehorses is the most challenging for them. How about for you? Would that be accurate? Is that a challenge for you?
It's definitely it was a thought before I went to college, and that's why I actually went to Long Island University as a business major, to try to learn how to operate a business and that side of running a training operation. And I feel that the 2 years I did there, I did very well and learned a lot, and it's paid dividends today.
Yeah, talking to Matt O'Connor here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton, off and running with that training career. When will we see Duelist again?
He breathed last week. We're probably going to give him one more maintenance work and then look for a race for him. But he's doing very well once again. So we just have to spot him in the right place, and hopefully he gives us another win.
Yeah, how long did it take you to learn how to, well, and I know you're still learning, but how to spot your horses properly?
I've read the condition books and stuff like that as a teenager, so I knew a lot about it, and I think one of the best trainers out there in spotting their horses in places where they could win is Robert Falcone Jr., who I worked with, and that was a key takeaway. And then when I was with Zito, he let me go through the book and kind of pick races for horses, and I think I have a lot of experience with knowing what type of horses fit where in regards to speed figures and rag sheets and thoroughgraphs and stuff like that. And that's how we spot our horses.
Yeah, take a minute and explain that to people, Matt, because some people might hear you referencing the condition book and all those types of things, and they're going, what on earth is he talking about, a book? Don't they just put their horses in a race? Explain how that process works.
So there's various conditions, in not necessarily degree of difficulty, but the group of horses you're running against. So obviously maidens or horses who've never won a race before. Then you could go non-winners of one race other than, which is typically allowance conditions for horses who have won no race other than a maiden or maiden claiming race. And non-winners of two life claimers, horses who have never won two races lifetime. And it progresses up their ranks, and the higher you go in the condition, the more purse money and better quality of horses.
Yeah, of course, you need to get those better horses if you're going to compete in those types of races. But, that first win coming in a maiden claiming race at Gulfstream, and there's nothing wrong with that either. I've always said that the thrill of winning any race, forget about what kind of race it is, I'm sure winning the Kentucky Derby is a different thrill, but any race is one of those things that if we could bottle it and market it, this would be the easiest sport in the world to promote.
Oh, absolutely. If a regular person could get the feeling that you get when you see a horse you're involved with or a horse you own cross the finish line first, we wouldn't have any problems, that's for sure.
How'd you end up getting Tyler Gaffalione to ride your horse?
So I knew Tyler well for the past couple of years, and I decided to make a jockey change out of that first time I ran him, and just called Matt Musiker, his agent, and he gave me the call on him, and Tyler got him home for me.
Yeah, what did he say to you after the race?
He was just happy for me. He was smiling for me every year and just congratulated me and told me great job, and hopefully we could get him back on Duelist and hopefully a couple more of our horses. He's a great up-and-coming rider. People say he's up-and-coming, but I think it's fair to say that he's a veteran now. He knows what he's doing, and he can only go up from where he is.
Do you think that trainers have go-to riders, Matt?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you develop relationships with riders. Like, per se, Johnny V and Todd is a duo that you've seen for years. And they're just in the barn more. They get to know your horses better in the mornings. And I think that relationship you build with specific riders, you trust them more in regards to riding in the afternoon.
So if you had to win one horse race, you got one shot to win it, that's it. Which jockey are you choosing?
I don't know. That's a tough one. There's a bunch of good ones out there. I don't want to upset anybody, but I would being part of the Always Dreaming team, I'd have to go with Johnny V and under the spotlight because he's one of the greatest riders of all time.
Yeah, you're not going to upset anybody by choosing Johnny V because his resume speaks for itself. Yeah, he's another guy that you talked about, Kieran, at the top of the show when I mentioned Kieran being with me on this program a couple weeks ago. There, you talked about him being a great ambassador and a class act. John Velasquez falls into that same category.
Absolutely, Johnny. Johnny's an A1 guy as well, and he does great things for the sport and just great. He's a great person overall.
So if Johnny says I want to ride Duelist, is Tyler out?
I don't know. That one I have to think about. if you went on him, I think you get the first call back. So I'd probably stick with Tyler in that situation. But yeah. I don't think Johnny would want to ride my two-life claimer.
Matt O'Connor with me here on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton, having a lot of fun on this visit. If you miss any portion of the show, all you have to do is head back to my website. That's horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast of this show and all of our shows at horseracingradio.net. Hey, Matt, we're putting together this fun little fantasy derby for the first Saturday in May, and it's going to be a full one-hour broadcast that we're producing here on the network. 9 of the 13 Triple Crown winners are going to compete in a 20-horse field that it's 20 of the top Derby winners of all time that were voted on by our listeners and by industry folks. So it includes, you know, Barbaro and Funnyside and I mentioned the Triple Crown winners, but there are so many top horses in this race. If you could train one of those Triple Crown winners, one of the 13, who would it be?
I think the obvious go-to would be Secretary. He was just a different kind of animal. Even I never saw him run live, but you watch videos and replays and movies on him, and it's just amazing what that horse did and the whole backstory behind him.
You think you would have won the Triple Crown with Secretariat?
I think anyone would have won the Triple Crown with Secretariat. he was something else.
Did you have I know you mentioned the one of your favorite horses, but did you have other horses that you fell in love with and maybe had pictures of around the house or whatever it might be when you were a kid?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Barbara was one of them. And actually I had bought a picture in the yard at Saratoga, and one morning at Chitino's barn, Edgar Prado came by and signed it for me. And that's definitely one horse who influenced me, not into getting into the game, but into being 110% mentally focused into the game.
Yeah, I can believe that. Have you had the chance to talk to Edgar about that and tell him that story?
When I was younger, yeah, but I haven't seen him around here. I know he's riding down here, but I haven't seen him because the barn area is closed to the jockeys, so it's just whoever's in there can work in there, and trainers come in and out, and that's it.
Do you plan on staying in Florida even after everything is passed with COVID-19?
Well, our plan was to go up to Saratoga, so we're going to plan accordingly as if that's what we're going to do and kind of play it by ear and see what happens with the unsteady state of racing Northeast right now.
Yeah, believe it or not, Matt, we're inside the final 5 minutes of the program, and I like to maybe touch on some other things we haven't touched on yet. I'll do that here in a second, but what do you enjoy most about training racehorses?
I think the best thing about training racehorses is the challenge of getting them fit, figuring them out. I've probably said it 100 times, but just overall the process from phase one into getting them to the races, and when they win, it's just a great feeling.
All right, Matt O'Connor here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. All right, Matt, in the final couple of minutes here, tell me some things that we haven't touched on yet that maybe people don't know about you in terms of other hobbies or other sports you follow, other teams, whatever it might be.
I'm a big hockey guy, and being friendly with Vinny, and my dad is actually director of security over there at the BB&T Center. I follow the Florida Panthers a lot. And they're making a little push, but the COVID break, obviously, we'll see what happens with the seasons and sports like that. But other than that, I just train horses and go fishing and take naps. That's about it.
Yeah, you go fishing in the ocean down there?
Yeah, actually, I went out with Joe Bravo a couple times, saltwater fishing, and then my blacksmith has a boat as well, and I go fishing with him several times a week.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you got in touch with Joe Bravo and David Fox, too. They're one and 1A when it comes to fishing down there.
Yeah, I got to go. I haven't been out with David Fox yet, but hopefully I get an invite soon, see what happens. I have to send him the recording.
Yeah, exactly. How about your favorite food? You can have one last meal in life. What's it going to be?
Then it would have to be steak. I just like steak. Maybe a little surf and turf, a little lobster tail, but steak is definitely the go-to.
Yeah, good man. When you get up here to Kentucky, when all this is passed, I'll take you out to Tony's Steak and Seafood here. Tony's Steakhouse is amazing. We'll do that next time.
Oh, yeah, it's very good. We had dinner there with when Greenpoint Crusader ran in the Breeders' Cup.
Yeah, fantastic place. Matt, listen, I really appreciate the visit. Can't believe we're out of time. All the best moving forward, and keep it rolling. Let's do this thing.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate you having me.
All right. For my producer, Lee Delapina, for my special guest, Matt O'Connor, I'm Mike Penna. Visit our website, horseracingradio.net, to check out the program of this show. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.